The multi-billionaire leader of Hamas is dead. So is one of Hezbollah's top military commanders, a man who had a $5 million bounty on his head from the United States. Okay. It's a big victory for Israel and a pretty huge setback for Iran. But does it mean World War III? Meanwhile, Iran's friends in Venezuela remain in power after rigging an election. Migrants continue to be welcomed into the United States while they provoke riots in the UK. And Russia is training its troops on using battlefield nuclear weapons. We have all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Iran's new president was inaugurated this week, which meant that many of Iran's terrorist clients traveled to Tehran to all get together, have a good time, chant death to America, etc. But the inauguration provided an opportunity for Israel to take out someone very high on their hit list. To tell us more about it, we'll hear from our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic. Mihailo, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Yes, Ismail Haniyeh, the chairman of the Politburo of Hamas, which is the closest thing they have to a physical leader, was assassinated in a hotel room in Tehran on the morning of July 31st with a bodyguard of his. He was there, as you mentioned, for the inauguration of Iran's new president, Masoud Pezeshkian. He was not the only foreign representative of a terrorist group or whatnot there. But he was taken out. This was a bit of a shock to a lot of people, including the Iranians. They actually held his funeral in Iran rather than transporting him to the West Bank somehow or something like that, which goes to show how much they valued his friendship and, of course, sponsoring of Hamas itself. How much influence on the ground this means for Hamas, for the Israel-Hamas war, remains to be seen. There's a lot of speculation as to how much control he actually had over Yahya Sinwar and all the guys in Gaza. But at least for the moment, Hamas is essentially headless.
Yeah, that's quite the coup. Assuming it is Israel, I mean, I think you were saying earlier, they haven't claimed that they did this, but at the same time, they don't always. But assuming it is, it seems like a major intelligence coup for Israel to take out someone of this leadership. I mean, if I were a terrorist leader, I'd think twice before visiting Iran now.
Oh, totally. And I mean, Israel hasn't infiltrated Iran for quite a while. There's a few years back, a really famous, important nuclear scientist got mowed down by assassins on a motorbike. So Israel has its tentacles in Iran. But for somebody, like you were saying, of this caliber, somebody that they've been hunting for a long time, really that the Ayatollah himself obviously values a lot, is pretty remarkable. Haniyeh and some of his other cronies for this time have been living in Qatar for the past while. Qatar is not the friendliest country to Israel, but Israel promised the leadership there that they wouldn't assassinate any of these figures while they were on Qatari soil, and Tehran's not on Qatari soil. So
I think it's a... Yeah, that is the big question now, is what is Iran going to do? I mean, I think there's an interesting lesson in international diplomacy from a lot of this, where Iran is very pushy. They push everyone around whenever they can, but you have to stand up to them. And if you stand up to them, it seems like often it's they back down a bit. I mean, we saw that with Donald Trump, where he dealt very effectively with Iran by killing Qassem Soleimani, and Iran was quiet for pretty much the rest of his term in office. And it reminds me of this statement in the King of the South booklet by Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry that says, superpowers cannot survive in this evil, warring world without the will to wage long, hard wars. This is the real world in which we live. Fantasies won't change that reality. If you have the will to confront someone like Iran, the way that Israel is doing, often it works. You have to, Israel under Netanyahu has shown this to a certain extent, that if you stand up for yourself, it gets results. And you can see why so many people want to get rid of him, because he is showing the world really how to stand up for evil. I think his example is quite a strong rebuke to the United States. And maybe you see this even more in this second assassination that you alluded to, because Haniyeh wasn't the only leader killed this week. Israel went after a top Hezbollah commander in Beirut, a man the U.S. has been after for years, even offering a $5 million bounty for any information on his whereabouts. What can you tell us about him, Mihailo?
Yes, I believe you're referring to Fuad Shukr, who was assassinated, as he mentioned, in a suburb of Beirut. He's a longtime Hezbollah member. He's been fighting Israel since 1982, which, for some perspective, that's before Hamas was even founded. I think the year is 1987. I don't have it off the top of my head, but he attacked a U.S. base in Lebanon when that was a bit more of a crisis spot, and you had more international actors coming there, which I believe killed about maybe 45 people, something like that. He's been a longtime Hezbollah insider. He's been called the right-hand man of Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah. Benjamin Netanyahu, in a speech he gave Wednesday night, called him Hezbollah's chief of staff. The reason that they started or took him out was because of a terror attack that Israel blamed him for on last Saturday, where Hezbollah attacked a civilian football pitch or soccer pitch, where unfortunately 12 children died. It was a Druze neighborhood. A lot of people like to frame the Israel's terror war as, oh, it's just those Jews talking about. In this case, it was an Arabic group that had their children, civilians, just taken out. So it's really all the nation coming together. Israel's not just Jewish per se. But anyway, he died. And at the time of recording today, Yoav Gallant, who's the defense minister in Israel, announced that Mohammed Daif was killed last month. He's the, I guess the easiest way to describe him would be the main commander of Hamas in Gaza. Again, he's been dead for about half a month now, but we just found out about this today. This leaves a huge leadership void in Gaza itself. And again, how this is going to impact everything on the ground remains to be seen. But slowly but surely, Hamas is losing their top brass one by one.
Some good points. Before we move on to some of this, I think it's worth still thinking a bit about this attack on the Shaba Farms, on that Druze community where 12 people were killed, because that was the biggest attack since on civilians since October 7th. And I think one thing from all of these stories is that the mainstream media doesn't cover themselves in a whole lot of glory this week. We've seen the typical obituaries that you tend to get from the mainstream media whenever some Islamist dies, austere religious clinic, austere religious cleric, that kind of treatment where they don't mention all of the atrocities that they've done. But then with the farms, I was following some of Honest Reporting's coverage on this, and I think it was just absolutely astonishing where the Washington Post in particular, their headline was "Attacks in Gaza and Golan Heights kills more than 40, many of them children." I mean, you read that and it sounds like it's the Israelis killing children. Like, that doesn't sound like, I mean, that completely misrepresents it. And when you understand that so many people get their news by just flicking through headlines rather than reading down, and I don't know what paragraph it actually gave you the truth, but there's that. And then CNN, this got me as well, because I write headlines. We all, you know, we all of us here are journalists. We all try and write headlines, and we're always desperate to get people to read our articles. You want to make it sound as dramatic as possible while still being true, so people come and read this thing that you've put hours of effort into. CNN's headline, they try to make it as boring as possible. It's like they don't want anyone to know about what is happening here. Their headline was "Video shows scenes in Israel-controlled Golan Heights in area of rocket attack." Really? Video show scenes? It is absolutely absurd. But you have to ask yourself, why are the mainstream media so keen on downplaying it when it's Israeli children die, whereas front page, like, they blast it everywhere if it's Palestinian children? And then if you're on social media, quite regularly you'll get children that have been killed in Syria, or conflicts that have nothing to do with Israel, portrayed as if they are victims of Israel. I think that shows this clear anti-Israel agenda here. But the big question that's on everybody's mind, and certainly if you've been judging by the mainstream coverage this week, this is what, say, the Associated Press, all these others have been arguing about. Is this World War III? Or at least, does this mean a direct confrontation, direct war now between Iran and Israel?
Well, we'll have to wait and see, but highly unlikely. This happened before when we've had in April, Iran sent its barrage of drones that all got shot down. Iran said, okay, that's our vengeance and we'll move on. Something like this is probably going to continue. And the way Israel has been responding to these attacks against Iran, against Hezbollah, against some of these other groups, I think sends a pretty clear message that is making a lot of people scared, alluding to something you mentioned too earlier, in that the head of Hamas can go to Tehran, the heart of the beast, the nerve center of evil, and still get taken out. Or the number two man in Hezbollah, or all these other guys. And every terrorist leader right now is probably getting the message, if Israel really wants me dead, they can have me over in a heartbeat. That's probably what Hassan Nasrallah is thinking. That's probably what Khaled Mashal, who's most likely going to be Haniyeh's successor in Qatar, that's probably what he's thinking. That may be, very well even be what the Ayatollah is thinking if he ever travels abroad. I don't know if Israel will be that bold to try that, but it's still a possibility. And like you said, once you push back at Iran, they start getting a more realistic view at what's going to happen, and they start hitting the brakes.
Yeah, and I tend to agree. I think when you have a biblical understanding of even human nature, of how you confront evil, to really call Iran and as a rogue state and a terrorist sponsoring nation what it is, then yeah, strength tends to not lead to war. It generally, or at least not, it will make them back down. It deals with them, and really, they weakness makes them bolder. But we're not saying, okay, well, peace coming in the Middle East, and this is where. Our analysis guided by prophecy, we're not saying switch off, don't look at the Middle East. Instead, we're saying scrutinize it very closely, and we're watching for a few very specific things.
Yes, one of the biggest things we're watching for is a crisis to occur over Jerusalem, which is funny because most of the Israeli crisis so far, whether it's Gaza or the Golan Heights, Jerusalem itself has sort of slipped under a lot of people's radar. But that's what the big prize is. That's why all these Islamist groups are warring against Israel in the first place. And there's a particular prophecy in the book of Zechariah that tells us why we should watch Jerusalem, at least for the immediate, for the catalyst for a lot of other things going on. It reads this way: Behold, the day of the Lord comes, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of you. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city will go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people will not be cut off from the city. That's in verses 1 and 2 of Zechariah 14. This is what our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, wrote in a booklet he wrote a while back now, but seems to be getting more and more relevance, called Jerusalem Prophecy. Quote, "The subject is the day of the Lord, the end time. Christ prophesied that he would gather all nations to battle him in Jerusalem. Then he makes what might appear to be a strange statement. One half of Jerusalem is to be taken captive. Notice how specific this prophecy is. East Jerusalem, one half of the city, will be conquered by the Palestinians." A bit further down, he says, "Looking at the ongoing violence in Jerusalem today, we can easily see how one half of Jerusalem shall be taken captive in the very near future. The present violence is an embryo that is about to explode into much greater violence," end quote. And now, based off of this prophecy, based off of Mr. Fleury's analysis, one of the things we're watching for is for Palestinian politics to get a bit more volatile, to get a bit more aggressive, for some of these groups to get a foothold in the West Bank where they can seize Jerusalem a lot better than they could, say, in Gaza or even in Lebanon. At the moment, especially in the West Bank, Palestinian politics is so divided, so weak, they are incapable of conducting this kind of coordinated assault and even annexation. And the faction that controls most of the West Bank, Fatah, at this point, they're just too concerned about keeping their own survival. And are willing to work with Israel to do that than, say, attacking Jerusalem at this point. We expect a more radical group like Hamas, perhaps, to get into the West Bank at some point. And who knows how this will all play out, but the fact that you're having all these leadership vacuums happen right now that need replacing, that need new people in offices to make decisions, we could very well see somebody fulfilling Haniyeh's position or some of these other positions that are now vacant, that are a lot more aggressive, that are a lot more willing to take risks, that perhaps are a lot more ambitious in what they want to seize. Or this could all mean that Hamas is going to fizzle out, and some other group like Palestinian Islamic Jihad that we just mentioned might be able to fill a vacuum and start moving their weight around a little bit. Remains to be seen again, we'll see, but there are a lot of ways where this could play out.
Great, thank you very much. And I think that is an important reminder. I mean, you look prophetically, we are expecting President Donald Trump to return to the White House and to come with that a certain recovery and reprieve for Israel and the Middle East, things could get better for them for a bit. And I think some of Mr. Netanyahu's strength in dealing with Iran could help, that we're seeing right now may well pave a way for that. But it's critical to keep watching these events in Jerusalem. If that reprieve comes along, it is only temporary. There are still very important events to come there. Well, moving from Iran to what is, in a lot of ways, an Iranian outpost in America's backyard. The incumbent president, Nicolas Maduro, won Venezuela's elections over the weekend. The official figures put his vote at 51% of the vote. And of course, Venezuela is a communist country. So these were not particularly free or fair elections. Maduro imprisons and persecutes political opponents. His most potent adversaries were barred from running. International observers were banned, including a plane full of four former Latin American presidents who were coming to come and make sure the election was free and fair from quite a high profile. They weren't allowed in. Exit poll, even with all of that cheating, exit polls showed the opposition actually winning by a landslide. And though it looks like that election was rigged and Maduro managed to hold on to power. Now, Venezuela is basically an enemy outpost, dangerously close to the United States of America. Maduro's victory is going to ensure that it stays like that way. So I'd like to bring in our guests that are joining us from the United States, Andrew Miller and Jeremiah Jacques, into this discussion. Now, Andrew, this is something that very clearly and directly implicates the United States, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is definitely, I'd even go as far as say, is like you could pin this rigged election in Venezuela on the Obama administration and the Biden administration. And so just to recap what I mean by that is when the Donald Trump was president, National Security Advisor John Bolton was very clear that Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua formed what he called the Troika of Tyranny. It's these three communist nations in Latin America working together against the United States. Now, what Trump did to try to defend the United States from these three nations is just put very severe sanctions on all three of them, and I think especially Cuba and Venezuela. Because the Cuban economy, it's been in power since the it's been in communist since the 50s. It would have collapsed years ago without Venezuelan oil. And so they've got this deal with the Venezuelans where the Venezuelans give the Cubans oil, and the Cubans in turn give security guards and spies and other people to prop up the Maduro regime, because Maduro is so unpopular with his own people, he actually needs to hire Cuban security details to defend, like protect his life and help him keep control over the reins of government. He probably would have been forced out of power a long time ago without those Cubans. So Trump's strategies seem to be working, except that when Trump left the White House, Joe Biden, under Barack Obama's direction and support, he stopped those sanctions. He eased those sanctions on Venezuela, let this trading between Cuba and Venezuela continue, where they're trading oil for security officials. And it basically strengthened his regime enough that he's still able to use these Cuban experts to help keep his government in power, even when the people don't like him. And they haven't been very grateful to the Biden administration for what they've done either. They actually the crime in Venezuela has gone quite a bit down because Trump even praised Maduro for this. He said he was a smart leader because he's deported many of the Venezuelan gangs and let them walk up through Mexico into the United States. So the crime rate in Venezuela went down quite a bit because the people committing the crimes are now here in America. And so, and the Biden administration let that happen by removing these sanctions.
And this is a really long-standing, propping up Venezuela, a really long-standing Obama-era policy. I mean, I think one of the most astonishing news pieces that most people are generally ignorant of is Operation Cassandra, where, I mean, this is where the American news media, I think, covers up, not by like you can find information about Operation Cassandra. It's there in all the major newspapers, but nobody made a big deal of it. And I think most people are ignorant of it. But it's an absolutely astonishing thing where you had a period of time there where, thanks to a series of drug deals and things like that between Venezuela and Hezbollah, and working with all of these drug cartels and links up into the United States, you had $200 million a month being deposited in a Lebanese bank account. It was called the largest material support scheme for terrorism operations in world history. So Venezuela is a key part of Iran's terrorist network. And it was Barack Obama that essentially shut down Operation Cassandra. He was trying to do the Iran deal. He was trying to enable Iran. You've got this investigation that this was coming from the Drug Enforcement Agency. Those were the people running this Operation Cassandra, revealing everything going on in Venezuela. And he did everything he could to frustrate and ultimately pull the plug on this investigation. So, a major danger to the United States. And this is where I think it's worth turning back to Mihailo as well, because there are deep links between Iran and Venezuela, right?
Oh, very much. Even going back to Hugo Chavez, of course, Maduro's mentor, who was in power in 1999, or at least that's when he became president. And never mind the fact that everything you just mentioned is true, the fact that Venezuela is funding Hezbollah, funding the war that we just talked about earlier of, attacking the Golan Heights and that kind of thing. Hezbollah literally trains in Venezuela. You literally have places, including one particular island over there that has a large Lebanese expat community, where you ha can find Hezbollah paramilitary training over there in South America, like way on the other side of the Middle East. And there's even, I believe it was last year when Iran was sending a ship to outside of the Middle East to go and project a little bit of power. One of the ports of call that was in Venezuela. So Iran is turning Venezuela basically almost into a colony, into an Iranian New World colony in South America, and tying into those refugees or migrants that you were talking about. If Hezbollah, if Iran, if all these figures are that deeply enmeshed into Venezuela, and Venezuela is one of the prime sources of these migrants, what if you connect? It doesn't take much connecting the dots to wonder how many terrorists, how many Middle Eastern terrorists are sneaking into the US southern border through Venezuela and Nicaragua and Cuba and those other places you mentioned.
And it gets worse. I think we can bring Jeremiah into the discussion at this point as well, because it's not just Iran that Venezuela has strong links to either. It's also Russia, it's also China, and it's also some of these Asian countries.
That's exactly right. Yes, Russia and China are a huge part of the reason why America's efforts to isolate Venezuela have failed. Russia and China are a huge part of the reason why Maduro remains in power year after year, oppressing his people and turning his country into a socialist dumpster fire. Russia and China have been especially close to Venezuela since Chavez came into power back in 99 and started turning, transforming it into this communist utopia that it is today. Russia and China are now Venezuela's biggest creditors. China is its biggest trade partner by a wide margin. And Venezuela is Russia's most important trade partner and military ally in all of Latin America, even more important to Russia than those nations like Cuba and Nicaragua that Andrew just mentioned a moment ago there. And the foundation of all of this is a shared hatred for America and a shared desire to end the era of America's global dominance. Russia and China will basically support any regime on earth that shares in their desire to close the curtain on US dominance. So they've invested a lot over the years into Venezuela, and they've helped to make it essentially, as you said there, Mr. Palmer, a socialist or a communist outpost that's geographically close to the United States.
And that is something that's just incredibly dangerous. And I think we can get into that a little bit more, but I think it's worth, I think just looking at the notes here, Andrew, your main story basically ties right into some of these issues that we're seeing in Venezuela, particularly the migrant issues, right?
Yeah, the main story is because, as I alluded to earlier, like I said, the Democratic presidential nominee in the United States, Joe Biden, has resigned, and his vice president, Kamala Harris, is running for office. And so the fact that she's running for office has really shown a great big spotlight on the border issues, because the news media is trying to pull an Orwellian memory hole trick on us right now. But very shortly after Biden was put into office, he made his vice president, Kamala Harris, his border czar. Now, that's not an official constitutional position. It's just a colloquial term saying that, like, as vice president, the vice president constitutionally doesn't do much other than cast tie-breaking votes in the Senate. So they have some time for special projects. And so her special project was border security. For a long time, Harris was kind of the public face of the Biden border administration security efforts, or lack thereof. Now, because, as I mentioned earlier, inflation and immigration are the two issues Americans are most upset about, having the border czar run for president is not a great election strategy. It's a great gift to Donald Trump to be able to run all the immigration ads against Harris. So the media is now trying to claim that, like, well, Harris was never the border czar. America doesn't have a border czar. It's like, well, yes, America doesn't have a border czar. It's not an official position. But Harris was given that assignment. And some of these media outlets, like Axios, were actually pretty instrumental in calling her the border czar, and have only in, like, the past week decided to, like, treat themselves from the past as a different person. And pivot away from this. But it is a huge issue Americans are concerned about, because since the Biden and Harris administration was installed, I checked the numbers yesterday, and it's about 8.1 million illegal immigrants have been apprehended at the southern border. And actually, less than half of them are Mexicans. You think they're coming across the Mexican border that they'd be Mexicans, but the majority of them are not Mexicans. They're Venezuelans or Cubans or Nicaraguans or Guatemalans. There's actually a number of Lebanese Hezbollah supporters, Chinese, quite a few Chinese. Like, basically, as you heard from Mr. Zekic and Mr. Jacques, you've got nations from around the world that are kind of using Venezuela as, like, their landing point to get into the new world and then just come up the border into the United States. And the Biden-Harris administration has really opened the door for that to happen. Trump had a policy, a very effective policy, called the Remain in Mexico Agreement. And so what he said is, like, he said, okay, he's like, occasionally there is an oppressed family fleeing drug cartel violence that applies for asylum in the United States. And the United States, because we're nice people, want to give them asylum. They said, the problem we're having right now is these 8.1 million people just walk across the border. We don't have enough judges to try 8.1 million asylum cases. So you put them in these camps, which fill up very quickly. And then after that, you're like, all right, well, just go out into the United States and pinky promise you'll come back for your court hearing. Trump fixed all that with this Remain in Mexico agreement, where he's like, okay, it's like, you have to stay in a migrant camp on the Mexican side of the border until a U.S. judge has time to hear your asylum case. Now, Biden and Harris got rid of that almost first thing. So the Mexicans were immediately like, well, it's not our problem if Venezuelan gang members come, because they're not staying here anyway. They're going to the United States. Just this week, Senator Elizabeth Warren was saying that she actually wants a pathway to citizenship for all the illegal immigrants in America. Said last Sunday that she's confident that if the American people elect Kamala Harris, Harris will work with Congress to make sure that pathway to citizenship is had. And so it really pays off for those illegals. They didn't have to stay in Mexico until a judge ruled that whether they're really qualify for asylum. just drug cartel agents and Chinese spies and Hezbollah terrorists and everyone else can pour in unvetted and now have a path to citizenship in the United States if Harris and Warren get their way.
And that really does raise the question of why. You know, this is not just one person, Kamala. Like, there's a whole organization that has decided we want to encourage mass migration. We want to bring as many people into the country as possible. It, you know, it's no accident. They're not surprised. They knew this would happen. I think for sake of time on that subject, I have to refer you to our sister show, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, or the Trumpet Daily Show, that has had a lot of great coverage on the migration crisis. The they've lent me their mug. There we go, Trumpet Daily Show. You can go look that up on Rumble. I think for sake of time for us, this, you know, going back to Venezuela, all of these migrants coming in from Latin America, I mean, this does tie into a very specific prophesied curse, where in the book of Deuteronomy, God outlines to his people, to the nations of Israel, which Britain and America are descended from biblical Israel. That is just the fundamental key to understanding world events. That's something Herbert W. Armstrong proves in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, which we're very happy to send to you for free. But it says specifically, if you disobey me, these are the curses that I'm going to punish you with to help you turn around and to bring Israel back to God. And what we're seeing on the Mexican border, what we're seeing in Venezuela, really does relate directly to one of those curses, does it not, Andrew?
Yeah, absolutely. The Deuteronomy 28 and its companion chapter in Leviticus 26 are just filled with the type of curses God brings on, has prophesied to bring on end time Israel to correct them. One of them in Deuteronomy 28, verse 52, and this is talking about a curse that's to come on America and Britain, says, "And he shall besiege you in all your gates until your high and fenced walls come down wherein you trusted throughout all your land. He will besiege you in all your gates throughout your land, which the Lord your God has given you." And our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, explains in the, actually it's in the Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet booklet that he's written, that reference to being besieged in all your gates is more about like international trade gates, sea gates, like the Panama Canal, the Suez Canal, the Straits of Gibraltar. But that reference to your high and fenced walls, that's not about a gate, that's about like border security, like the border wall Donald Trump wanted to build on the Mexican border. And he says your high and fenced walls will come down, and it will just enable foreigners and criminals from all over the world, not just Mexico, but like we've been talking about, Mexico and Guatemala and Nicaragua and Venezuela and Cuba and China and Russia and the Congo and various Middle Eastern nations. They can all come from all over the world and gather in Venezuela or Mexico directly, and then just walk up and cross the border. Because when Joe Biden, one of his first executive orders, his first day in office, was to cancel Trump's border wall. So your high and fenced wall literally came down. And then also, I don't know if it was that first afternoon, but shortly afterwards, got rid of that Remain in Mexico agreement. So now you don't have to wait in Mexico till we can vet you and see if you're really an oppressed refugee. But you can just come to the United States and stay here and trade drugs and trade children and involve in counterfeiting and sell used cars on the African market to send money to the Middle East to kill Jews in the next to the West Bank. And so it's it's all just a really horrible curse on the nation that's resulted in America's literally under siege, where we have no high and fenced walls. And it wasn't and it's not even that these criminals from all over the world have tore down those high and fenced walls. It's a very radical American regime in the United States tore down the wall itself to allow all these people to just pour in at the rate of about 6,000 a day, last I checked.
Yes, and there are, I mean, we're seeing a dramatic fulfillment of that prophecy. And then there are other prophecies that add more details, where you have later prophets come along and, you know, add their warning to those kind of basic blessings and cursings that God recorded from Moses. And I think we're seeing some of these in the UK. I mean, the book of Hosea specifically addresses Ephraim, which in Bible prophecy is referring to Britain. I think in principle, everything it says there refers to all of Israel as well. And it has a lot to say about migrant curses, about you know, problems with integration and large numbers of foreigners in your country. And I think we're really seeing that over here in the UK as well, where one of the top stories right now from Britain this week has all revolved around migrants, where you had a second generation immigrant, you know, someone who was born in the UK, but I think both of his parents came in from Rwanda. And he went on a stabbing spree at a dance class in Southport near Liverpool. And he killed three children. I think two initially, a third was in critical condition and then died. There's quite another number of others that were very seriously injured. And then that's led to riots and a lot of unrest. And I think Melanie Phillips had a really good article on this, where I think a lot of people in Britain are feeling like they're having a hard time getting to the truth of what is happening with these stabbings, what is happening to the riots, because they're becoming used to their government lying to them and trying to hide facts when it comes to issues about the migration crisis. But there were riots last night. It certainly looks like there were people overturning police cars and things like that. But it's a lot of tension that is coming from having large numbers of migrants being brought here in a government that doesn't really do much about the issue. But this was something that was prophesied as well, where the book of Hosea talks about Ephraim being oppressed and broken in judgment, making exactly these kind of mistakes, making foolish decisions. It says Ephraim has mixed himself among the peoples, so among the nations, among the foreigners. They've mixed a lot of people in there. Ephraim is a cake not turned, the idea being it looks great on the outside, but because this cake hasn't been turned, it's burnt out and hollow on the inside. There are things that can look good, but society is crumbling from within. So these are all dramatic prophecies that are being fulfilled in Britain, in America as well. And we had a lot to say about this whole subject in our April Trumpet print magazine. Right on the front cover, it says there, invasion. It gets into what is happening in Britain, in the United States. It brings in Canada. The statistics from Canada are astonishing. I think just from memory, I think it's something like 500,000 people a year, which when their population is, I think, somewhere around 30, 40 million, that's a massive amount of migration. It's there in Australia. It's there in all of these different countries. And that magazine looks at the agenda behind why and what's happening there. But given also this whole conversation about Venezuela, one last article I'd also like to bring up is one by two of our panelists here, Andrew Miller and Jeremiah Jacques. They had a great article back in 2019, Preparing to Storm America's Castle, that takes you through the Bible prophecy, that also takes you through the geopolitics. And I think this is something that people in general don't recognize enough, that if more people just listened to geopolitical experts and people that have a real grounding in history and in geography, I think they'd have a much more sober view of international relations, of America's position in the world, Britain's position, France, their nation's position. Obviously, those kind of experts don't have the forecast and the hope that the Bible can provide, but there's a grounding in reality with that, when they are really grounded in history and geography, that I think too many people lack today. And they really talk about how concerned America needs to be with what is going on in Venezuela and Cuba. And if you allow foreign nations to get a foothold in these countries, they can choke off America's trade, that these are vital trade arteries. And we kind of live in this unreality where nations don't get their trades cut off, or if they do, it's third or second world countries, and they're people far from us. It's not something that we can imagine happening to rich, developed first world countries, whether in the United States or in Europe. But there's real danger in foreign countries setting up soil in setting up on close to America's soil in places like Venezuela. You have a real danger from huge numbers of migrants coming in. You have a real danger from those trade arteries being cut. So that article, Preparing to Storm America's Castle, adds another very important dimension, I think, to that story. Andrew, before we let you go, that, of course, is not, you know, migration, everything we've seen here. That's not the only story that we've had from the United States this week. Can you give us a rundown of some of the other important news events?
Yeah, well, if the two issues Americans are most concerned about is migration and inflation, this has been a bad week for them, because in addition to all the migration curses we've been talking about, the U.S. national debt just surpassed $35 trillion this week. So we're now well above 100% of gross domestic product and the national debt. A lot of financial experts are concerned, yet the Treasury Department has come out and estimated that it actually plans on borrowing another $1.3 trillion in the next 6 months. So the amount of debt America's taking on is expanding, the amount of money supply is expanding, which is going to have the effect of making American money worth less on the international scene, meaning your dollars will purchase less. In addition to that, there's still a lot of questions people are asking about the assassination attempt on Donald Trump's life. We're still having congressional hearings about that. This week, the deputy director of the FBI got up and said that he couldn't say too much about Thomas Crook's social media accounts, except that he seems to have expressed anti-Semitic and anti-immigration views. Then the CEO of Gab did something that's fairly unprecedented. They normally keep accounts locked, came out and actually posted screenshots of the Gab media account in crisis, basically revealing that the FBI was lying to Congress. Even Elon Musk said it looks like they perjured themselves, and that he didn't release all of the Epic Microwave posts attributed to Crooks, but the posts he did release actually were defending Joe Biden's immigration record. So if this account really does belong to Thomas Crooks, and the FBI says they think it's his, he was not posting anti-immigration sentiment. Rather, he was saying that he was very supportive of everything Biden's done, all the executive orders he's made with immigration, showing that while there is still questions that remain, the man who tried to kill Donald Trump was a pretty pro-Biden left-wing radical who obviously did not like Donald Trump's stance on immigration and very much supported Joe Biden's stance on immigration.
All right, starting and finishing with immigration. Thank you for that, Andrew. Well, the final region of the world we need to talk about is Asia. Jeremiah, can you give us the rundown of important stories from that part of the world?
Yes. First of all, a quick China story that at first glance might seem like China is reducing its support for Russia's war on Ukraine. So this was on Wednesday that the Chinese imposed export controls on drones and drone parts. And this includes drones and drone components that Russia relies on a great deal to keep on attacking Ukraine. And this might seem like good news for those who would like Russia to be isolated. But the truth is, this is a meaningless gesture that will change virtually nothing. All this means is that these Chinese drones will now get exported to a shell company, probably in Kazakhstan, which will then ship it to another shell company somewhere in perhaps Turkey or Malaysia. And then from there, Russia can buy this equipment no problem. So it might add a few rubles on top of the original price, but it's still every bit as accessible to the Russian war machine. So it's just another situation where China tries to portray itself as being neutral in the war, at least to a degree. It does this mostly to try to keep from ruining its ties with Europe. But China is far from neutral. And the truth is, China is well positioned to deal a devastating blow to Russia's military-industrial complex. But instead, it keeps doing all it can behind the scenes to keep Russia going. And then a couple of quick stories here from what you could call the Russian hypocrisy files. Russia's anti-corruption general was arrested this week for taking bribes. And then Russia's family values czar, she left her husband this week, who is a priest, by the way, and she left him to be with a Russian billionaire. And then, as if those stories were not enough, a spokesman for Russia's government came out on Wednesday, and in the most scathing language, he condemned Israel killing the leader of Hamas. So Russia said this was, quote, absolutely unacceptable political murder. Once again, Russia, you know, which poisons or defenestrates anyone who politically opposes the Putin regime, got on a high horse to criticize Israel's, quote, unacceptable political murder of the Hamas leader. So Russia's hypocrisy was really an overdrive this week.
A lot of pots calling the kettle black there. Now, we started this show by kind of talking about World War III, and are we going to see that triggered between Israel and Iran? We're kind of circling back now, I guess, to conclude with the prospect of nuclear World War III with your top story.
That's right. Yes, the top story I wanted to talk about is that Russia is training troops to use nuclear weapons on the battlefield. This was announced by Russia's defense ministry on Wednesday, and the plan involves training Russian soldiers in the southern and central military districts to first secure tactical nuclear warheads onto Russia's Iskander M ballistic missiles, and then load those nuclear armed missiles onto various warplanes, and then finally in how to fly those warplanes on missions, which would launch those nuclear missiles at their targets. So this is intricate training that Russian soldiers are undergoing, and it's all for the purpose of being prepared to strike Ukraine with nuclear weapons. Now, these are tactical nuclear weapons. As I said, that means they're smaller and less powerful than strategic nuclear weapons. They're designed for use on a battlefield in a military situation instead of being designed to flatten entire cities the way many strategic ones are. But even still, this is something that we can be sure the Europeans are deeply rattled by. This is only the latest sign of Russia's determination to conquer Ukraine, and it's only the latest threat by Russia to use nuclear weapons. And Ukraine is, of course, in Europe. You know, it's part of Eastern Europe. It borders EU nations. And so Russia's aggression is something that the Europeans have been shaken by and changed by. Just a few days ago, Poland's foreign minister warned European allies that Russia's aggression and all the questions about America's reliability mean Europe needs to change more profoundly than it already has. The foreign minister prepared a 5-page document that he gave to other EU leaders all about this, just stressing that the nations of Europe need to be more militarily powerful and more militarily unified with each other. So that's been a huge part of the story with Russia's war since the beginning. This war is terrifying to Europeans, and especially Eastern Europeans, and that fear is bringing about a more militarized and a more closely unified European alliance.
I think that's an important point. I don't know whether it would have been in the document that you're talking about, but I did see where I think it was Poland's foreign minister told Hungary, you should quit the EU and go make a, you know, join Russia. From this perspective of, we want to have a joint military, we want to unify, we need urgently to do much more together, and you're standing in the way. Get out of here.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, Hungary has been very firmly in the Russian camp. I wouldn't say firmly, but yeah, but they're definitely wavering between Europe and Russia. And Orban is a close ally to Putin. So you can see why someone like Poland says, look, just get out of here if you're going to be the weak link and prevent us from being as unified as we want to be.
And it's a great example of how this whole story is pushing Europe in the direction that we're expecting from Bible prophecy, where we have a whole number of very specific forecasts. You know, not just generally Europe's going to become more powerful. That is part of it. There's a lot more specific detail to that, though, based on what we get in the Bible. And one of those is a Europe that shrinks down from 23 nations to 10 nations. You know, that's just one detail, not necessarily the most important. And, you know, Hungary may well be one of those 10 nations. Maybe they won't. But the fact that you're having Poland kind of saying, look, we need a smaller European Union so that we can respond to Russia's aggression. You know, that's a very specific fulfillment of what we're watching for. And there are a whole number of other specifics.
That's right. And one thing that Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has called attention to since the start of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, all the way back in 2014, is Europe's reaction to it, Europe's reaction to Russia's belligerence and its nuclear threats. And Mr. Fleury has explained that that is because of Bible prophecy. He wrote an article back in 2014 that says, "We've been prophesying for around 70 years that Eastern Europe would become a vital part of a new European superpower, a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire." And then he says, "The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way and in precise accordance with the Bible's description of that European empire. Europe's new fear of Russia is going to play a major role in hastening the fulfillment of that prophecy," end quote. So, you know, with Russian soldiers now actively training to strike Ukraine with nuclear weapons, it is vital for us to keep on watching Europe's response. Many Europeans have been shaken by the core, and we just have to understand that that fear is transforming Europe.
And I mean, what bigger source of fear than nuclear weapons? I mean, I think it was a few months ago, but I think I'm sure I've seen stories about how, say, you're still getting birth defects in Norwegian sheep due to Chernobyl, which was, of course, a nuclear accident in Ukraine. Like, use of nuclear weapons or nuclear fallout in Ukraine, it is going to affect the rest of Europe. If Russia goes on to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine, it is going to spread. And of course, you know, the fallout from these small nukes wouldn't be necessarily the same as a nuclear power station going. There's a lot of different variables there. Not all nuclear explosions are the same. But you can really see how this could spread fear. And these tactical nukes, these are something that at least the kind of the think tanks that study nuclear weapons, they're especially concerned about, because they do feel more usable. Like, if you're going to use a nuclear weapon to wipe out a city, that's kind of a big deal. Whereas it doesn't feel as much of a big deal to use a nuclear weapon to take out 100 tanks or something like that. And so there is this fear that this is something that is easy to escalate. And, you know, those experts, whether they're right or wrong, they're certainly going to be making that case in European capitals. They're certainly going to be saying, you know, we really need to take a response to this. And then even these Iskander missiles, I think these are particularly scary missiles, nuclear weapons on intermediate range ballistic missiles, missiles that don't span and hit anywhere in the earth. You know, intercontinental missiles go into space and come back down. They're awesome in every sense of the word in terms of kind of terrifying weapons. But they you have some time before they hit the target. They go very fast, but they go into space. Things like this Iskander missile hit their target a lot quicker, which means you don't have as long to make a decision. Do I respond to this? Do I strike back? And so I think for that, they're also especially scary. So Russia was talking about some of the weapons that, say, weapons experts and all these people are most worried about. So absolutely, you can see how, you know, Europe has been responding to the Ukraine war for the last couple of years. There have been major response already. This is driving change. You can absolutely see how this particular story could drive some very quick change over the weeks and months ahead. Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. And we'll leave a link to that article, "The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe," and the link to all of the other articles that we've mentioned on this show in our show notes. If you're new to this show, or certainly to this video format, this is our first video week in review, our first week in review as in Trumpet World. we would love you to engage more deeply with the material that we've talked about on this show. We do, when we're saying, well, the Bible says this, the Bible prophesies that, we don't want you to take our word for it. And we know that on this format, especially on this Friday show where we're hitting all of the high spots from the week, we are not going to have the time to prove everything thoroughly, especially if you're a new viewer. But we don't want you to take our word for it. Prove it for yourself. You know, we're talking about the future of mankind. We're talking about nuclear war. Is there hope for mankind? I mean, ultimately, what we're telling you is that all of these different news events that you saw throughout this week tie directly into your Bible. And that at the end of the day, these different events may involve terrifying, horrifying weapons, but they prove that God rules in the kingdom of man. They prove that ultimately God is in control of all of these events, and they're all unfolding according to a plan. And that plan does not end in human annihilation. It ends in this world coming to know God, understanding the causes of all of the problems that you see all around us, and God's government, God's truth, God's law, fixing those causes and bringing paradise to earth. That ultimately is where all of this is leading. And when you see all of these news events from this past week in that light, understanding that it's all part of God's plan and God's prophecy, there is a huge amount of hope there. So that's why we really want you to take this, study it, prove it for yourself. This is too important for you to just take our words for it. So all of those different articles, we will leave that in our show notes for you to follow up on. All of those different pieces. And like I said, if you're brand new to us, if you want to know where to start, I would really encourage you to read that book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. We only mentioned it briefly on the show, but that is just so foundational. That is the master key to what the Bible says is going on in modern times, to understanding all of these modern events in Bible prophecy. So if you have not read that, please do go on our website, thetrumpet.com, read it online, or even better, get your own free print copy, so that you can get it out alongside your Bible and dig into that. If you want to know more about that, if you have any questions, if you have any comments as we kind of bring this show to you in a pretty new format, please do get in touch. You can email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thank you so much to everybody joining us today. Thank you to George Haddad and Isaac Lorenz for engineering and production. We'll be back with the show on Wednesday. And until then, keep watching your world.